I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this month, New Jersey voters voted to raise the minimum wage in their state from $7.25 to $8.25 an hour. They now join 21 other states and D.C. that have approved minimum wages above the federal level of $7.25. The Fair Minimum Wage Act, introduced by two Democrats in Congress, would raise the federal minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. The president has said he supports an increase, and so does a majority of the American people. That's according to a recent Gallup poll. But economists are not in agreement about the benefits of raising the minimum wage, our topic for Radio Times. And let me introduce two economists to you. John Schmidt is senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., co-author of three editions of The State of Working America, joining us from NPR in Washington. And John Schmidt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Also with us is David Newmark. He's a professor of economics at the University of California at Irvine, also director of the Center for Economics and Public Policy. Got up very early to join us on Radio Times. And David Newmark, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure.
John, let me begin with you. And David, I want to have you chime in as well before we get into the meat of our discussion. Who are we talking about when we talk about people who are working for the minimum wage? And John, let me start with you. How many people?
It's important to distinguish between the people who are working just exactly at the minimum wage, which is a relatively small number, a few percent of the labor force, and the share of workers that would receive an increase if the minimum wage went to the proposed, say, $10.10 an hour. And there we get to a much bigger chunk of the labor force, over about, say, 10% or so.
And that's between the people making $7.25 and those that might be making something like $10 an hour?
Exactly.
And if we break it down age-wise, are we talking about teenagers, young adults, families? Who are we talking about?
Well, teenagers tend to work at low wages, but they're not the majority of low-wage workers. Again, if you look at workers in that range from about $7.25 to about $10.10, teenagers are maybe 10 to 12%. A big chunk, maybe another fourth or so, is 20 to 24. And then over half of people in that low-wage sector are workers 25 years and older.
And David, what kind of jobs are we talking about here when we talk about, I guess, low-wage jobs or minimum-wage jobs?
Let me just say one thing first. I mean,
sure.
Those numbers are roughly accurate. Those are facts. There's no dispute about those. I think this issue of teenagers at minimum-wage jobs, it sort of gets overstated by some and understated by others. I mean, it's certainly true that teenagers aren't a majority of minimum-wage workers, as some simplifications might suggest, but that would be awfully surprising because there aren't that many teenagers to go around, right? But the young people are, just to reiterate this, very strongly overrepresented relative to the share of the workforce or relative to the share of the population among low-wage workers. So it's important to keep that in mind.
And when you say young, I don't want to have too many definitions to start our show, but when you say young, David, what are we talking about?
Well, I think in this research literature, people talk about teens, by which we usually mean 16 to 19, and youth, by which we mean 16 to 24. So those are the two groups that tend to get talked about a lot, mainly for historical reasons of the way the data came to us. But, you know, young workers have not yet acquired many skills, and that's why they're overrepresented at low-wage jobs. And that is very important for kind of some of the stuff we're going to get into, presumably, which is how well minimum wages actually target poor families. What kind of jobs are they?
Yeah.
You asked. I mean, they're a lot of service jobs. There are not many manufacturing jobs, although there are some very low wage manufacturing jobs. Child care workers, especially the people who aren't the head teacher in the classroom. All over the place. I mean, people who, documented workers who are doing gardening and things like that. I mean, they're everywhere, but they're obviously concentrated in retail and sort of low-skilled services.
Would it be fair to say, John Schmidt, that we're talking about what low-skill, low-wage jobs then?
I think they're low-wage jobs. Not all of them are low-skilled jobs, but I think, especially if you look at the kinds of people who hold those jobs, about 10% of workers who make in that range of $7.25 to $10.10 actually have college degrees, and a far smaller percentage of that workforce has less than a high school degree now than was the case, say, 30 or 40 years ago. It's only about 20% or so.
But to you, John, I mean, is it time to raise the federal minimum wage?
I think it's definitely something we should be doing. It's important, I think, to understand just how far the value of the minimum wage adjusted for inflation, has fallen since its peak. If you go back to 1968, when the United States had about half of the income per person that it does right now, we actually paid workers about 30% more at the bottom, at the minimum wage, than we pay them right now. I think that's a tremendous index of just how much inequality has grown and how much the benefits of economic growth have not been available to workers at the bottom.
Let me ask you, David, if the minimum wage, let's say, was raised over time to something like $10.10 an hour, would that hurt employment?
Yes, it would hurt employment. Let me circle back to a couple of the points that were made, though. I think to provide some more context, it is true that we have rising inequality. Everyone knows that. No one disagrees about that. It is true that there are fewer people with less than a high school degree at the minimum wage, but there's a lot fewer people in the population with less than a high school degree. I think this argument that the minimum wage has fallen so much in real terms, and therefore we ought to raise it, it combines a fact and a sort of moral imperative that don't necessarily go together. It's true the minimum wage has declined in real terms. That's obvious. However, we now use other policies to provide an income support to low-skilled, low-income working people. We didn't, back in 1968, the year John used, have an earned income tax credit, and now we do. The earned income tax credit is a very aggressive program that provides families, with more income if they work and if they have kids, in particular, and if they, of course, have low incomes. So the maximum subsidy a family gets now is over $4,000. So if you're making $10 an hour, that can be a very large percentage increase to your income. So I think to talk about, policy A has gotten more stingy, but not to recognize that we now have policy B, which is meant to achieve very many of the same purposes and has gotten very generous, can be very misleading. If you look at the two together, minimum wages and the EITC, the real value of sort of what we kind of provide or guarantee as a minimum income floor has stayed kind of the same and even gone up a little bit. Now, it's true that who gets it changes, right? The minimum wage, obviously, is just a wage floor. You cannot pay a wage less than the minimum wage. So whether you're in a rich family or poor family, if you happen to be low wage, you get the minimum wage. The earned income tax credit targets low-income and poor families. So if you're a middle-class teenager working at a minimum wage job, the earned income tax credit gives you nothing. If you're a single male, it essentially gives you nothing. If you're a family, especially a single mother with kids, it gives you a lot. So we've kind of changed who gets what. Right. But in general, we provide an income floor for working people through a different mechanism. That in and of itself doesn't mean the minimum wage shouldn't go up, but it's misleading to just refer to the decline in the real value of the minimum wage as if that's the whole story.
And David, just hold on, because I want to give John a chance to respond to that comment. Is David correct, which is that we have some supports for poor families that we didn't have back in the 1960s?
That is definitely true, but I think you could draw from that conclusion there that somehow these are competing policies, that we should either do the minimum wage or we should do the earned income tax credit. And I think actually these are strongly complementary policies. The minimum wage helps to make sure that the workers that David mentioned that aren't covered by the earned income tax credit can benefit from wage increases. But much more importantly, what it does is it helps to turn a system that is a large wage subsidy to low-wage workers, but also to low-wage employers, into something that is a smaller subsidy, a smaller burden to taxpayers, and it shifts the cost, if you have a higher minimum wage, onto employers themselves in a more equitable sense. So to give you a quick example, imagine that the minimum wage were $5, and with the EITC, workers actually receive $10. That $5 subsidy would be coming from taxpayers. Having a $7 minimum wage, say, would help to shift some of the costs for supporting those low-wage workers back onto the employers who benefit from having them. And I think it makes sense to strike a balance there, and they're not in any way competing. I think they're actually strongly complementary.
And David, are you okay there? I hear you coughing.
No, fine.
Okay. But let me pick up on what John just said there, which is that with these lower wage jobs, the taxpayers end up subsidizing workers as opposed to their employers paying them more.
Well, I mean, it is certainly true that if you subsidize employment, and we do it two ways. One is we do it through the EITC, which is essentially a subsidy to workers, right? We'll pay you more if you work. and that increases labor supply, and that pushes down the wage a little bit. But we've chosen as a society, and it's somewhat unique, more unique to the United States, let's say, than other Western countries, to really push people to work because we think that's better in the long run. It does push wages down a little bit. If we subsidize employers, like through a hiring credit, the same thing would happen. But, you know, I think it's so in terms of the underlying economics, that's right. But we have to remember, somebody's paying for this anyway. So, I mean, we hear a lot lately about this argument. It's come up with the, sort of the fast food strikes and the Walmart walkouts, you know, that we're sort of subsidizing these big companies, because we you know, they pay the workers low wages and then we come in with benefits. Well, I guess the question is, what's the alternative, right? Mm. I assume that's not an argument for just cutting benefits, and I'm sure John wouldn't make that argument, nor would I. But obviously that would be one way to stop subsidizing them. You know, it comes back to the question you asked that we jumped over, but I'm sure we'll come back to. If minimum wages do create some job loss, right, and I think the research is convincing, but we can I'm sure we'll debate that. But if they create some job loss, then we sort of have a choice. We could have, you know, more people working at low wages, and then if we think those low wages don't provide a sufficient level of income, we kick in with other things. And that's what we do now. Right? We have Medicaid, we have the Earned Income Tax Credit, we have food stamps, some places we have housing support. Or we could have higher wages, somewhat fewer people working. Those people working at higher wages would be eligible for less benefits because that's the way those benefits work.
Right.
The people not working would be getting more benefits. Now, is that better? It's not clear to me. I mean, different societies can, you know, make different choices along that continuum. I tend to think it's not better because one thing we know from labor economics and, you know, decades and decades of research is earnings grow with time in the workforce, right? So if you miss out on work opportunities, especially young people, that hurts you forever, right? Because the earnings grow about 4 or 5% a year earlier in the labor market and kind of 2 to 3% for many more years in the labor market. You know, if you don't get that growth, you just start at a lower level and you're growing from there. And that's a problem, and that's a cost that we pay if we choose sort of the high wage strategy, more support for those not working, but less quote unquote subsidies to those who are working.
And John, we have about 45 seconds before our first break here. But do you see minimum raise, increasing the minimum wage that would result in job loss?
No, I think I have a different reading of the data, and it will take more than 45 seconds to go through it, but I'm happy to talk about that. I think that the evidence is much more mixed and strongly suggests no matter what, we're looking at pretty small effects.
Well, we're going to pick up on that after this very short break. And again, that's John Schmidt, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research, and also with us, David Newmark, professor of economics at the University of California at Irvine, and he's the director of the Center for Economics and Public Policy. We are getting two opinions about the minimum wage and whether it's time to raise it or not, the effects if it were raised, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. John, we'll give you more than 45 seconds after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Simpson Meadows, a retirement community in Downingtown, PA, in Chester County. Managed by Simpson Senior Services, a nonprofit with a long-standing tradition of care. Simpson Meadows provides personal care for senior adults, along with memory care, respite, and independent living. A specially designed personal care neighborhood staffed with licensed nurses provides assistance with daily tasks to help residents remain as independent as possible. More at simpsonmeadows.org.
Online dating sites are more popular than ever with many different kinds of people, but did you know that Asian women get the most attention on these sites? We'll head into the beauty shop to ask our panel of commentators about the new data about online dating and their own dream dates and nightmare scenarios. That's next time on Tell Me More.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
What did the Warren Commission know, and when did they know it?
The key effort was to try to find exactly the precise moment in time at which the president was hit by the first shot.
An investigator from the Warren Commission joins us as we broadcast from Dallas, where President John F. Kennedy was assassinated 50 years ago this month. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are looking for answers to these questions. Is it time to raise the minimum wage? Would it be good for the economy? Would it reduce poverty? Would it hurt businesses? And I guess, again, our guests are economists John Schmidt and David Newmark, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. John, back to you. Would increasing the minimum wage result in layoffs or cut back in hours?
I don't think so. To me, what is striking about the research on the minimum wage is that the economists who look at it across the board find large increases in wages, noticeable, observable increases in wages for workers that typically work at the minimum wage or near the minimum wage, such as teenagers or fast food workers. But those same economists, when they look at what's happening on the employment side, there's a lot of disagreement. There's controversy there. Some argue that the minimum wage has small effects to moderate effects along the lines of what David's research has pointed to. But a lot of others find little or no effect whatsoever. And to me, with apologies to physicists, you know, it's a little bit like, you know, when theory suggests that there's a particle that's very, very small and people go off and look for it and they argue about whether they found it or not. And I'm exaggerating it somewhat, but I think that that's what we're talking about here. The effects, to the extent that they are truly negative effects on employment, as David would suggest, are actually quite small. And I think the reading of the data is that the reason why we're having trouble finding those effects and so many economists don't find them is because what we're looking for is small. To give you a quick example, if we had 100 teenagers that were working at the minimum wage, according to the consensus range, I think that David would agree with, that their employment would fall by 1 to 2% if we had a 10% increase in employment, in the minimum wage, excuse me. So that means 98 or 99 teenagers would get a wage increase, and one or two might lose their job under that scenario. Those are fairly small effects. I think it's probably closer to zero or a half. If that's the case, we're talking about a very big increase for a large group of workers and no effects or little effects on employment for a very small number of workers.
David, do you see small effects the way John does?
Well, the range of estimates he described is sort of correct, but not quite, not interpreted quite correctly. So cut me off if this gets a little technical, but I'll try to keep it simple. I mean, the estimates say the following. They say if you raise the, let's say we're studying teenagers. That's the most common group to study. We're studying teenagers. If we raise the minimum wage by 10%, how much does teen employment fall? Now, what John said I'm not saying deliberately, but just, you know, a little doesn't quite give the right answer, because not all teenagers work at the minimum wage, okay? So what we find is, let's take the 1% figure to be closer to John's range of estimates. Teen employment falls by 1%, but if only half of teenage workers work for the minimum wage, right, then two teenagers lose their jobs. Uh-huh. And conversely, not all teenagers get the minimum wage increase, because only those who work at the minimum wage get that increase. So actually, these modest effects, they're a bit like asking what happens to the demand for apples if we raise the price of Macintosh apples, and that's not the right calculation, because you can substitute towards other apples. You want to ask what happens to the price of Macintosh, what happens to demand for Macintosh apples if we raise the price of Macintosh apples. I've debated, you know, many, many times, as has John, on this topic. And interestingly, others, you know, with whom John is more in agreement on what the evidence says in terms of no effect or negative effect, kind of agree that the negative effects I tend to find actually aren't nearly as trivial as he makes them out to be. Are they huge? Absolutely not. When people say, well, you know, when business groups say raising the minimum wage will put the economy back into recession, I mean, that's ridiculous, right? Nobody thinks this is big relative to the economy or even relative to the low-skill workforce as a whole, but it's not so trivial.
Well, let me ask you, David, that one of the arguments in favor of raising the minimum wage is that it would create less turnover, it would increase productivity. I know Costco, StrideRight, these are two companies that have raised their minimum wages and have seen positive results. Is that an argument that sits well with you?
Well, yes and no. They Costco hasn't raised their minimum wage. They've raised the wage they've chosen to pay, right? There's across companies, certainly across industries and even within industries, there was a big range of wages. There have always, I mean, this is something labor economists have documented back to the 1940s, right, that not every worker gets paid, you know, take similar workers in different firms, even in the same industry, their wages are very different. Because some firm decides, you know, we'd actually like to have a low turnover workforce, maybe higher morale because we pay them more. Maybe, you know, they'll get more training or we'll train them more and we'll keep them. For whatever reason, that works for us. Other employers decide, you know what, we don't really care. If it takes a day to learn a job, you know, and there's not really much scope for sort of loyalty or morality because the job is incredibly routinized, we can do fine with low wages and high turnover and not much commitment to the company, and that works for us. So the fact that some companies do that is pay a high wage and get, you know, of course they will get higher productivity and certainly lower turnover, doesn't mean that it's good for other companies. And this is an argument that often comes up in the minimum wage debate that I think is quite misleading. And the other thing to keep in mind is, you know, if one company raises its wage, turnover will fall, right? Because now that's a really good place to work relative right. to all the other places you can work, right? Because it pays a higher wage, so you don't want to leave that job and you don't want to lose that job. If the government says all companies are going to pay a higher wage, that sort of relative difference that leads to lower turnover doesn't really work anymore. Now, are there some potential offsets when a minimum wage is increased? Sure, right? You know, some of these positive things will happen, but I don't think there's any basis for saying, in some sense, the government's going to do a better job at picking the wage that is best for these companies, and the companies are picking the wrong wage. That argument I find a little less convincing.
Well, John, let me ask you a question, because we focused a lot on the impact of on teenage workers, but I want to talk about the adults and perhaps even the working poor in this country, which is always two words that just sort of catch in my throat. It just doesn't feel right to say that. But looking at increasing the minimum wage for families, would it get people out of poverty? Would it have a beneficial effect on the economy as you see it?
I think the minimum wage is not primarily about poverty. I think it's about reducing inequality, and I think it's about helping to improve the bargaining power of workers at the bottom by having sort of us as a community stand behind those workers and say to the employer, who has a lot of power in the low-wage labor market, that, you know, you have to pay this person more than what you're paying them right now. And I would emphasize not the impact on people who are below the federal poverty line, which is a very low number, you know, less than $20,000 for a family of three is a pretty tough way to get by. But half of the benefits of increasing the minimum wage to $10.10 would go to families who earn, who have incomes of less than $40,000. And about 70% would go to families that have incomes of less than $60,000. I think that is the kind of change in the middle and the bottom of the income distribution that we're desperately in need of at the moment.
When we see the monthly job numbers, and John, let me go back to you and then David, and then we'll get to our callers, what we see that even the jobs that are being created, it seems as if they're not necessarily minimum wage jobs, but they are low wage jobs, and we have this income disparity in this country. Do you see the minimum wages as part of that explanation about why we have this growing gap between rich and poor?
I think it's an important part. It's not the whole story, but it's an important part. And I think it's important for people to understand that the United States economy was growing rapidly from the 30s to the 70s, and that was a time when inequality in this country, decade after decade, kept falling. And it's only in the last three and a half decades that we've seen a big increase in economic inequality. It's not inherent. There's nothing inherent about the U.S. economy historically that says that we have to have this increasing inequality. It was something that we basically chose through implementing policies that made it much harder for workers at the middle and the bottom to have bargaining power compared to their employers. There's been a big decline in unionization. We have entered into trade deals that are pit U.S. workers against low-wage workers in other countries without concerns for their circumstances. We have a dysfunctional immigration system. We have deregulated and privatized a lot of industries that used to be good paying jobs. And part of that is that we've also decreased the real value of the minimum wage. When you take all of those things together, I think that's where you find the root causes of rising inequality. And the minimum wage increase is one way, part of a way, to return to the kinds of systems that redistribute the benefits of economic growth down to the bottom and the middle.
And David, how do you see this gap?
That was a lot of points to respond to, so
it
I'm not going to try to hit all of them.
Okay.
The minimum wage has certainly played some role. I think it's pretty limited. I mean, we have good evidence on that. I don't think we really disagree. Certainly, if we raise the minimum wage, we would have less wage inequality at the bottom by construction. People do pretty much obey the minimum wage law. That's why it affects wages. We'd have more people out of work, though. So we'd have, you know, it's exactly what it does for income inequality as opposed to wage inequality. I mean, inequality has gone up for so many other reasons, and some are choices. I mean, it is true the minimum wage affects inequality. It is true unionization affects inequality. It is true that trade affects inequality, but it's way too simple to blame that all on policy. I mean, there's no question that technological change has played a huge role here. That's not a choice we made. Inequality has gone up in other countries with high minimum wages. Inequality has gone up a lot at places nowhere near the minimum wage. I mean, inequality between the top and the middle has gone up a lot. I don't think anyone blames that on the minimum wage. Mm-hmm. Trade, you know, that's a whole other show, and John and I are not international economics experts, but, you know, I mean, the trade has a lot of benefits, too, including, and this is very important, the prices of things that people buy. And we always forget that, you know, your wage matters because it buys stuff, and trade has really reduced prices, you know, and increased quality. I mean, I think of the cars we buy now versus the cars my parents had as a kid that had to be replaced every 3 years. Now I buy a car, and I kind of keep it till I'm bored with it because it runs forever. Trade has had tremendous benefits. It has, you know, certainly put low-skilled workers in more competition with workers from other countries, but it's delivered tremendous benefits. It's delivered even, you know, even bigger benefits to some of the countries we trade with. I mean, look what's happened to China, right? The millions and millions and millions of people lifted out of poverty because of trade. Is that something we don't care about and we only care about sort of, you know, poor people in this country? I mean, if I was the president, the answer would be yes. But as a human being, it's not so clear.
And that's David Newmark, who joins us along with John Schmidt. And we are talking about the minimum wage, whether it should or shouldn't be raised, how the minimum wage fits into our economy, and how it affects businesses as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. We have an anonymous caller from, looks like, Montgomery County. Go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
Yes, I'm a small business owner just outside of Philadelphia in the food industry, which we know is not a high-paying industry. And to take the extreme example of the city that you said raised their minimum wage to $15 an hour, that's what I pay some of my skilled labor, you know, my skilled employees. If I had to then pay my, say, dishwashers $15 an hour, my skilled employees are going to demand that I pay them more than what I'm paying, you know, the dishwashers. And that then puts me in a situation where I can't buy a wig on my business. And so I'd be curious what your guests have to say about that. And I keep my comments off the air.
I just have a quick question for you. In terms of your low-skill workers, I'm curious about what you do pay them.
So, I mean, it depends. You know, usually around $10 an hour is... I mean, I care very much about my employees, and I'm very sensitive to, you know, their financial needs. And so I would say I probably pay above what the industry in general pays because, you know, I work right alongside of them. I have a very small business. So I usually pay anywhere between $10 to $15 my employees. But if I have to pay $15 to the low, you know, skilled workers, what then would I have to pay my skilled workers?
I know I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and I was referring actually in my billboard to I guess it's a township or a community outside of Seattle that did vote to raise their minimum wage to $15 an hour. And John, she's saying if this became the law, she would, if she had to raise the lower wage workers in her business, she'd have to also raise the higher wage workers.
I think that that's likely to be true, but the key issue here is that the proposal on the table is not to raise the federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. It's to raise it to $10.10 an hour, which sounds like in the particular case here wouldn't even affect her business because that's what she seems to be paying her lowest wage workers. My argument would be that what we want to do is encourage all employers in, say, her industry or her sector to get onto the high road where she's already paying above, well above the minimum minimum wage. At this point, she's actually competing against companies and businesses that are in the same business and same industry and are paying presumably $7.25 or $8.50 or something below the $10 that she's paying based on what she said. I think, you know, we can use public policy to guide employers to take the high road and not to take the low road. And I think for them, they can be equally profitable. It sounds like her business is doing well. Mm-hmm. But the social impact is very, very different than if we have employers who pay $10 an hour versus if we have employers who pay $7 an hour.
David, does it make sense to have one minimum wage for the whole country? We're seeing states that are voting on increasing, and even communities voting on increasing their wages, which I guess creates a kind of a patchwork system, but maybe reflects some of the diversity of our U.S. economy.
Right. I think, you know, what's evolved, it really started in the late 1980s and has taken off, especially in the 2000s and now once again, is widely divergent minimum wage increases. I think it makes sense for two reasons. The good economist reason it makes sense is because wage levels are very different in different parts of the country. Right? A $10 minimum in California is a lot different than a $10 minimum in Mississippi, right? The position that a $10 minimum is not going to create disemployment effects in our very low-wage states, I just find kind of ludicrous, frankly. Is it going to make much difference in California and Massachusetts? Pennsylvania, I don't know. No, probably not, because many employers, you know, first of all, the state minimum wage is higher anyways, and second of all, they're higher wage areas. So in an economic perspective, it makes a lot of sense to have, you know, minimum wages that sort of reflect economic conditions to some extent. The more naive reason is, you know, sometimes I think the public listens to policy debate, not always, and sometimes it makes a choice. And voters, you know, ultimately can do what they want. I mean, I live in San Francisco, even though I teach at UC Irvine. San Francisco is a very liberal city. We have our own minimum wage. We've had it for a long time. Do I think it makes a lot of sense? Not necessarily. But, you know, voters have chosen, for whatever reason, maybe it's just a moral reason. We don't want employers to be able to pay less than X. And if they want to do that, let them do that. But given that it does come with some cost, I don't think imposing that on lower wage areas makes much sense. So you know, what we've kind of evolved to, and it's been pretty persistent over the last 20 years now, is widely varying minimum wages across states. High in a lot of states. It used to be just sort of the liberal coast states. Now it's not. Now there's a lot of other states, some in the West, some in the South, some in the Midwest, that have higher minimum wages. Lower wage states tend not to. That seems fairly reasonable. I think there's a reasonable question whether the federal government really does need to be stepping in here a lot to sort of, you know, boost the floor in low wage states relative to high wage states, or whether states are actually doing a pretty good job of making decisions that are, you know, somehow juggling all these conflicting things. You know, we don't want real low wages. There might be some job loss. Let's choose something that's appropriate for our state without throwing a lot of people out of work.
Well, we're almost up on the second break here, but David, since you're in San Francisco, has there been job loss as a result of increasing the minimum wage in that city?
There's a couple studies that I think are not very conclusive. It's very hard to answer that question for one city in particular. I will tell you one thing. I mean, one thing the policy is very reflective of, it's a question we haven't gotten into yet, is this issue of how well minimum wages target the poor. John, I think, to his credit, acknowledged that minimum wages really aren't about poverty. That's a point I rarely hear acknowledged by people who advocate for higher minimum wage, because a lot of minimum wage workers are not in poor families, although obviously some are. You know, my daughter was a high schooler when the city passed the minimum wage. She said, "This is great." I said, "Yeah, but it's not for you. There's no reason low-income people should be paying a higher wage so that you can earn more because you're in an upper middle class."
Well, we're going to take another short break, get back to our conversation, talking with David Newmark and John Schmidt, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Zollner Art Center at Lehigh University supports WHYY and welcomes John Lithgow Saturday, November 16th at 8 p.m. The Tony, Emmy, and Golden Globe award-winning actor will be presenting his one-man theatrical memoir, Stories by the Heart. Through his performance, he offers a touching and humorous reflection on storytelling as the tie that binds humanity. John Lithgow's Stories by the Heart is a family-friendly event for all ages. Tickets and information at 610 7LU Arts or zollnerartscenter.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Bruce Dern. He stars in the new Alexander Payne film, Nebraska, as an ex-alcoholic with early dementia who falls for a sweepstakes come-on. To play this character, who's a little removed from reality, Dern took out his hearing aids.
When you took out your hearing aids, how did that affect your performance? Huh?
Join us this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The news doesn't stop between Morning Edition and All Things Considered. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson, co-hosts for Here and Now,
your source for comprehensive news, information, and interviews in the middle of your day.
We're combining the resources of NPR and WBUR Boston to bring you stories that will keep you up to date.
Entertain you with features and music.
Join us Here and Now.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, again talking with David Newmark. He's director of the Center for Economics and Public Policy, and John Schmidt, who is a senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research. We're talking about whether increasing the minimum wage would stimulate the economy by giving low-wage workers more money to spend, or would it lead to fewer jobs and more joblessness? I do want to get back to our callers, but John, I have a question for you. Jason Furman, Obama's chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, gave a speech recently basically saying that if the minimum wage had kept up with productivity, the minimum wage today would be something like $20 an hour. Is that an argument that makes sense to you?
It does make sense. If you go back to the end of World War II and you look through the period to the early 1970s, the minimum wage increased pretty much in lockstep with the increase in productivity. Now, productivity is the amount of goods and services that the typical average worker in the United States produces in an hour of work. And that is probably the single most important determinant of our standard of living. So when that grows and wages grow in line with that, it means that essentially all of us are benefiting from those improvements in technology, education, the infrastructure of our economy, the things that make us the productive country that we are. And that broke down, that relationship broke down at the end of the 1960s. And I think it's another way to think about just how far out of line the minimum wage has come relative to the average worker or relative to the productive capacity of the country.
And David, I'm
so
sure
it makes sense. Do you think the minimum wage should be $20 an hour?
No, let me be clear.
Yeah,
I think that if we wanted to increase the minimum wage to that level, it took us a very long time to get that far behind, and I think we need to take a time to get back. Even the $10.10 proposal that's on the table is phased in over 3 years. I think sudden large increases are not going to be good for employment. I think phasing in moderate increases over a period of time are likely to have very little or no impact at all on employment.
And
employers
David,
adapt.
Employers adapt. David, hold on. We've got a caller, and I'm going to give you a chance to respond to his comment. We have, looks like, Mark from Yardley, Pennsylvania, joining us on Radio Times.
Hi,
Mark,
good morning.
Hi, go
good
ahead,
morning,
Mark. Everyone. Good morning.
I am a small business owner, and I actually do hire on day rate for employees to help me with some of my work. But one of the things that I was contemplating is that a minimum wage increase actually affects the lower income stratus of people. And those people, by and large, aren't savers, they're spenders. Therefore, that extra money that's coming into their pockets is almost guaranteed to be put back into the economy. And that would actually increase demand for products, goods, and services on a local level. So it almost seems that a wage increase would actually be an impetus for more spending in the economy and drive more hiring.
Mark,
and I take my responses off the air.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. David, what do you say to Mark?
Well, this is actually an argument that does get made sometimes. You mentioned Furman's speech, and you may have said that he said it as well. This is this notion that raising the minimum wage will actually stimulate the economy, by which I think we're talking about aggregate effects, right? Actually, you know, create visible job creation and economic growth. I don't think many people take that very seriously. It is true that very low-income people spend a larger share of their income than higher-income people. The difference isn't big, and we have to remember that it's not sort of the very rich that are the consumers of minimum wage products by the most part. It's a lot of other low-income people. Minimum wages do lead to price increases. We know that from the data. That's going to offset some of that. So I think, you know, the discussion of, you know, do we have more inequality than is acceptable? Is there some moral argument? This isn't something economists say against low-wage work. Those are all reasonable arguments to have, and do these actually help low-income families or not? I don't think they do, but we can discuss that. But pitching this as sort of aggregate stimulus activity, I don't think is the way to go, and I don't think there's much to it.
Is there much to it, John, from your perspective?
I think it's important to see the minimum wage as part of a bigger set of proposals that would seek to do that. I agree with David that the effects are not likely to be large. But, for example, to the extent that we have what I think are relatively small to zero negative effects on employment, these are the kinds of things that could potentially slightly offset some of those concerns that David has in that regard. But I agree. In and of itself, this is not the stimulus package that we all had hoped for. But it's something that points in that direction. It's part of a larger package of trying to get incomes into the middle and the bottom. I think it's right on target.
Mark, thanks.
Let me just add one more thing.
Yeah, go ahead. Marty.
You know, that's real stimulus, right? And, you know, maybe the government didn't do enough, maybe it should do more, maybe the Fed should do more, who knows. Real stimulus does matter. I mean, it is true what John said earlier, we had sort of rising inequality over the last 30 years. The one period where things reversed a little bit was sort of the late years of the Clinton administration, when the economy was really booming, unemployment was getting near 4%. That was the one period in recent decades when we saw the bottom catching up. So, you know, the best thing for people with low skills is really a booming economy and a very tight labor market.
Let me get Laurie from, it looks like, Flemington, New Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, Laurie, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Hi, I just wanted to comment that having the taxpayers in some way subsidize minimum wage increases seems like a specious argument to me, because some of the largest companies in the world, Apple Computer as an example, we pay taxes on the products when we buy them from Apple. People who work for Apple pay taxes on it, but yet Apple Computer does not pay taxes in the United States because they're offshored. So if the tax laws were changed, I guess my comment is the tax laws need to be changed to get people to be paying their taxes, and some of these arguments would really change.
Yeah, and Laura, that's not exactly about the minimum wage, but let me just see what John, let me give you a chance to respond to that, and then to you, David.
Well, I think the key issue is that the minimum wage is part of a broader set of changes that we need to make in order to turn things around in terms of inequality and reconnecting, you know, the typical worker in the United States to what is, you know, a tremendously rich and, you know, even with the recession that we've had, if you look over the long period of the last few decades, a very rapidly growing economy. And, you know, getting the tax situation right is important. Getting the minimum wage right is important. Restoring the strength of unions is important. Readdressing trade questions is important, and a lot of other issues. I just think it's part of a bigger picture.
David, anything you want to add to that?
I agree with the problem. Low wage work and low family income is a big problem, and I think one can easily, quite reasonably, look at the situation in the U.S. economy and say, in a country this rich, it's not acceptable the standard of living at which some families have to live. And that would certainly be my position. I don't view minimum wages and trade policy as really the right places to push the lever. And I think back to the caller's comment, look, one thing we know has changed dramatically in this country, far more striking than what's happened to the bottom of the income distribution, is what's happened to the top. I mean, Emmanuel Saez and Thomas Piketty have done this sort of seminal work working off of tax returns. And at the very, very top, just astounding increases in income growth. And taxes, you know, on them are arguably still pretty low. And the issue the caller raised about companies being able to evade taxes is also a real issue. I think there's a lot of scope for redistribution, personally. I think there's a lot of scope, and this is where the greatest potential is, in doing more to invest in education, both quality and quantity, so that workers can get skills, and older workers in particular can go back and get skills. That's more of a problem than addressing the issue for 16-year-olds, so they can actually earn a higher wage and get out of this. I think we as a society have become quite stingy in terms of our willingness to help poor and low-income families, and John and I probably agree on that in principle. I just don't think the minimum wage is the place to look, and I think it's actually quite misplaced.
Let me get another caller on. This is Wayne from Huntington Valley joining us on Radio Times. And Wayne, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, very good topic. I'm glad it's getting the civil discourse that it deserves.
Good.
But I have two comments. It's obviously a very noble thing to give people a higher wage. But when you think about it, if everything else you've talked about is a zero-sum game and it nets out, the unintended consequence of higher prices actually affects the same people we're trying to help disproportionately to the rest of the country. So in my mind, I think we're actually hurting them by actually pushing for a noble cause of a higher higher minimum wage.
Well, Wayne, let me take your comment. And actually, John, let me give you a chance to respond to that, something that David had raised earlier in the hour, which is that you've got, let's take a fast food restaurant. You've got people working there at relatively low wages, and largely the customer base are low-income customers.
The issue of the price effects of the minimum wage has been studied almost as much, well, not as much, but a lot relative to a lot of other issues we know. And I think that the conclusion of that research, and this is also, I believe, the conclusion in David's book with one of his colleagues, is that the price effects are likely to be small. And I think that, remember, you're raising people's incomes directly and you're increasing the price of some small portion of what they consume by a small amount, and that's assuming that the price increases actually go through, you know, even one for one. So the bottom effect on people whose low wage workers whose wages go up directly of the loss in income from the small increases in prices on that portion of their goods tends to be is going to be swamped. It's going to be much smaller.
I mean, David, if a hamburger were 5 cents more, would that hurt consumers?
Well, it would hurt them by 5 cents. No, John's right. The estimates of the effects of minimum wages on prices are not big, and there's certainly nothing like one for one. I have a paper up on my screen here. I have the advantage of sitting in my office, which John doesn't, which is a fast food study which says a 10% increase in the minimum wage raises fast food prices by about 1.5%. So I don't think the caller – I mean, the callers claim that it's sort of – or question, I should say, you know, can the price increases offset the wage increase? No, that clearly doesn't happen. There's just some offset. There's always a lot of offsets. But look, if you're a minimum wage worker and the minimum wage goes up and you still have your job and your hours haven't been reduced, you are clearly better off, right? And that's, you know, that's the only reason we're even having this discussion, right? Because the majority of people who are affected by a minimum wage will be made better off. They will have higher wages. They will still have their jobs because the job loss is by no means huge. And there might be some hours reductions, but again, many people will still end up earning more. And that's the sort of appeal. There's a reason opinion polls sort of come out, you know, pretty strongly in favor of minimum wages. That doesn't mean that's the whole story, of course. Mm-hmm. But obviously some people are helped, and no one, I don't think, on any side of the debate disputes that.
Let me get to, looks like John from Center City, Philadelphia, to join our conversation. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead, John.
I have a question for the guests. They seem to agree that perhaps this minimum wage increase isn't some big fix for anything. I'm wondering. I'm concerned about, say, the labor share. If you look at Grass's labor share, it's plummeted from even, you know, the 40s and 50s and stuff. It's really shocking. So what do the guests think about, as opposed to a minimum wage, instituting a maximum wage for the upper level? You know, the CEOs, they can only make a certain percentage of their lowest employee.
Well, that's an interesting comment. John, let me toss it first to you.
Well, I think it goes to an issue that involves just how much our expectations and social standards and norms have changed. If you go back to, you know, the 1960s, the gap between what a CEO made and what their production worker working in that CEO's firm made was much smaller than it is today, on the, you know, orders of magnitude smaller. And I think that had a lot to do with our tax policy. It had a lot to do with social norms. And I think a maximum wage, as something that would at least a discussion about that would focus mm-hmm. our attention on just how far wages at the top have risen. And the point that David made earlier, that's where so much of the increase in inequality has taken place. It's happening at the bottom too, but so much at the top. Anything that kind of focuses attention and gets us thinking and talking about that, I think would be useful.
David, do you like the idea of a maximum wage?
Not as policy. No, I think it would create all kinds of problems. I think there are reasons, aside from changes in social norms, that CEO pay has gone up. This is not an area in which I'm an expert, but there are certainly economists who argue that, you know, because the scope of companies has changed given technology and globalization, you're willing to pay a person more at the top. I think you know, but a discussion that sort of focuses attention on it, I have no objection to that, because you see some of the numbers and you say, oh my gosh, you know, do we really need to be paying this? Mm. And you know, some mechanism for shareholders to find out about this, and at least for them, and they're not the poor, they're the rich, of course, on average, although they're also pension funds, to ask, do we really need to be paying the CEO this kind of money to get the performance we want, or is somehow, you know, the CEO sort of captured the board and is getting ridiculous levels of pay? Seems a reasonable discussion to have. I should say that, you know, I don't think when you, I mean, it's true, labor share of national income has declined. I don't think that's all CEO pay. There aren't that many CEOs. So even if you take their huge salaries and multiply them by how many there are, you know, it's a lot of owners of shares of companies. I mean, a lot of this is profits, which goes to a lot of people other than CEOs, of course. You know, one idea that has been floated, I've yet to see anyone really put it in concrete terms, but I think it's something that sort of intrigues me, is, you know, it may be that the world has changed in such a way because of technology and globalization that capital share has kind of shifted up permanently. And then the question becomes, should we be thinking about ways where more people become part owners of capital? That is, you know, everyone has some, you know, more people, not just the rich and not just those with good pensions, but a far broader set of the population actually has some ownership of shares in companies, essentially, so that those profits, which are a higher share of income, are being shared more widely. It's a very fuzzy idea that hasn't been thought about, but I think it's worth
it. Well, it's interesting, and we should pick up on that. And John, since you're down there in Washington again, and I'm sorry about this, we're almost out of time here, do you think that there is some traction in Congress to raise the minimum wage?
Well, obviously, it's very difficult. I'm not a political scientist, but it's obviously very difficult to pass legislation to help workers, given the composition of the House at the moment and their opposition to the minimum wage. So I think in the short term, it's difficult, but I think it's a very important discussion to be having. And I think we've passed minimum wage increases in the past with Republicans in the House, Senate, and the White House even. So it is possible.
Mm, stay tuned. Well, my thanks to both of you for a very civil conversation. John Schmidt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And David Newmark, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. It was a good conversation.
A good conversation for us as well. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes to find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. Do stay with us for hour two, a special guest. We'll be right back.